I want to begin this morning in Proverbs chapter 1, if you'll go there in your Bible, Proverbs chapter 1. I want to read a little bit of this morning and then intertwine this section with a story, and then we'll make a few applications and be done this morning. Great to see everybody. Hope you'll join me in Proverbs 1. I'm going to pick up at verse number 8. You look there? Proverbs 1, verse 8. The wise man says, "Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Indeed, they are a graceful wreath to your head and ornaments about your neck. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, 'Come with us, let us lie in wait for blood, let us ambush the innocent without cause, let us swallow them alive like Sheol, even whole as those who go down to the pit,' we will find all kinds of precious wealth. We will fill our houses with spoil. Throw in your lot with us. We shall all have one purse. My son, do not walk in the way with them. Keep your feet from their path, for their feet run to evil, and they hasten to shed blood. Indeed, it is useless to spread the baited net in the sight of any bird, but they lie in wait for their own blood. They ambush their own lives. So are the ways of everyone who gains by violence. It takes away the life of its possessor." It has been almost 35 years ago that I met Ricky. We didn't know each other at all. In fact, his father had arranged for us to get together the first time. And so, as we sat down across from each other to get acquainted, we sort of shared our stories with each other. And I discovered as we did that in some ways they were quite similar to each other. We were both Texans, though from very different parts of Texas. You know that I'm a city boy from right here. Ricky grew up in a little East Texas town, some of you might know, Mount Pleasant, Texas. We both came from church-going families. If you've been around Kleinwood for a while, you know my family grew up here. Ricky's family attended the Southside Church, which was right on the main drag going through town in Mount Pleasant. And we were both born to families that were involved in the congregation. At the time I met Ricky, my dad was actually an elder of this church. Some of you remember that. And Ricky's dad was a preacher of sorts. He had a full-time job. He worked during the week, but on the weekends, sometimes he would go out to this little wide spot in the road, Cooper's Chapel, Texas. Ever been there? Yeah, I didn't think so. And at that time, there was still about a dozen mostly older people gathering in that old church building. If you're wondering, no air conditioning. Yeah, process that right now. And his dad would go out on the weekend sometimes, and he would preach for this group. Both of us, as young men, were encouraged to be involved along with our families. And so some of you will remember Billy Goff, who led singing for this church many, many years ago. Billy sort of manipulated me as a teenage boy and twisted my arm and got me started leading singing. And that's kind of how Ricky got involved at first, too. His dad would go out to preach for this little church, and when he was a teenage boy, he would drag him along, and dad would preach, and Ricky would lead the songs. And so, as we talked during that first meeting, I was impressed with how similar our experiences were. And yet, there the two of us sat, coming from such similar backgrounds. And yet, brothers and sisters, we were miles apart. I sat there as a young preacher, just starting out working with the church up in Huntsville, Texas. I was Hunter's age when I met Ricky. And across from me was a 30-year-old convicted murderer making his way through the legal process that would end his life. And so I have to tell you, I sat there wondering, how does that happen? How do two men coming from such similar circumstances with so many advantages end up in such drastically different places? Michael Graichik, a reporter for the Associated Press, asked Ricky that question in a different way. He said, how does the son of a preacher end up on death row? Since I came back to Kleinwood 2 years ago, I have had several people ask me, will you tell Ricky's story? And so I began to wonder, have I told Ricky's story here? And I know I did to the kids 15 years ago. I guess they're not kids anymore. They're probably grown up and married and have kids. And if I have ever shared this story with the group as a whole, it has been so long ago that I have forgotten. I don't know when that was if I did. And so since I was asked to share this lesson out in California last week, seemed like a good opportunity to honor the request that had been made and share it with you this morning. So how does the son of a preacher end up on death row? I don't know that I can give you an easy answer to that question. But I can tell you that if you ask Ricky the question, he would always go back to the same place. He would start by saying, I need to take you back to my freshman year of high school when I was 15 years old. And I began to choose a crowd of friends that were a negative influence on me. It is interesting to me that in his mind, that was the moment where everything in his life pivoted and his took a different direction. There were consequences that came with that choice of a crowd. He immediately began to get extraordinary pressure to do things that he'd always been taught growing up by mom and dad were wrong. First it was smoking, and then it was drinking, and then it was using drugs. And the more and more he was pressured by the crowd to do that, because that was his crowd, and that's who he wanted acceptance from, gradually he began to cave in, and he was caught up. He was caught up in that lie. In fact, in one of the letters that he wrote to me, he said this. He said, before I knew it, I was in with the ways of the world. I'm talking about sex, dope, drinking, thinking my parents didn't know what they were talking about, telling me not to do this or that. And I didn't like someone telling me how to run my life. Yeah, that sounds like a teenager, doesn't it? Sorry. He said, but as I look back on it now, my friends were running my life. And that began a path that continued throughout high school and into his adult life. He surrounded himself with the worst kinds of people. He used and abused every kind of drug, although he would say that marijuana became his drug of choice. He was involved in all kinds of immorality. I mean, it just was in every way a wicked life that he chose. Couldn't hold down a job. In fact, he described for me one time what was sort of the cycle he lived during the decade of his 20s. He said, I would go get a job, and I would work for a while, and I would take every dime that I didn't need to live, and I would save it. And I would save and save for 3 or 4 months, and when I had a little nest egg, I'd quit and go party. And I would party till the money was gone. And when I was broke, I'd go find another job and I would start the cycle over again. And so that's how he lived for a decade of his life. Until the spring of 1987, when he was on the downside of the cycle. He was broke, and not like you and I talk about being broke, okay? He was bad broke. It was so bad that he was literally living out of his car out at the state park. Worse, he didn't have any money to buy drugs. But he was with a woman at that time. who said she knew how they could get some quick money to buy drugs because back in her hometown, she knew a guy who owned a grocery store and he always carried a lot of cash on him. And so they planned to rob him. And the robbery did not go according to the plan. And that 22-year-old grocery store owner, Carl Wrinkle, was murdered. Well, it didn't take them very long to figure out who had done it. And the following November, it didn't take a jury very long to convict Ricky of the crime and to sentence him to die. And with that sentence, he would be shipped off to the Ellis unit in Huntsville, where he would wait for the courts and the lawyers to argue his case. And that's where we would meet. I was preaching in Huntsville. He was sent to the Ellis unit. Through the work of his dad, we had that first meeting. After that, we studied together. I think it was about 2.5 years before I moved away to Chicago and then later Orlando. And occasionally, when I could get back to Texas and had time to run and see him, I would. But mostly during the intervening decade, he and I corresponded back with each other. Lots and lots of letters back and forth. I have a whole stack of them, including this last one. He sent me this one in the summer of 1999. He wrote, "Dear David and family, how are you? Fine, I hope and pray. Myself, I'm very nervous. I'm in touch with the Lord this day more so than I have ever been. My heart feels like I can't get it to pump enough blood, and my hand feels like it wants to start shaking, but I'm holding fast to the word of the Lord. Just today, I was informed of my execution date. I will go to be with the saints that are awaiting for the day of judgment on August 4th, 1999. Well, brother, I'm sorry this letter is short, but I have much people to tell this to. So take care and remain strong as I am trying to do. God bless you. Love, Ricky Dawn." It would be a month later, on August 4th, 1999, that the state of Texas would execute Ricky for the murder of Carl Wrinkle. I was able to go out and spend his last 3 days with him and to be with him when he died and to help his family bury him in that little cemetery out by the church building in Cooper's Chapel. We talked about a lot of things those last 3 days, but the thing we talked about more than any was how much he hoped that people might learn from him, learn from his story. He very much wanted his story to be told, especially to young people. He had a special passion about young people and them knowing what had happened to him. And I don't think that's hard to figure out because he believed that so much of his trouble began in the choices he made when he was young. As I think back to the 11 years that the two of us spent visiting through that little window at the Ellis unit, it occurred to me that I had heard Ricky preach a lot of sermons that would never be preached in any church buildings like this one. And so what I would like to do is to share some of his lessons with you. And if you'll let me do that this morning, you'll help me keep a promise that I made to a friend 35 years ago. That his story would be told. And that maybe from the disaster that was his life, there might be some good thing that would come. I hope so. So, if he could stand up here this morning and Ricky could do the teaching, what would his lesson be? What would the sermon say? Surely one of the things that he would want to say to all of us is this. I think he would want to say that your crowd matters. Do you see that one? I begin here because it's where he would begin. And the lesson I heard him preach more frequently than any other, your crowd matters, right? No surprise there. Because in his mind, that's where his life pivoted. It all came back to his choice about the crowd. Again, from one of his letters, he wrote to me and said, I was baptized at 15 years old, and I helped my dad by leading singing every Sunday. As I got older, I started to have friends that were not Christians, and some of the things they did were fun. Some of the things they did, I didn't want to do, but my friends would say, oh, come on, it won't hurt you, or what's the matter, you're scared. And after a while, it was okay, so I thought. Started smoking cigarettes because my friends did. I started drinking because they did. And when I was in the ninth grade, I was introduced to smoking dope because my friends said, oh, you'll like it. And I did. Before I knew it, I was in with the ways of the world. Part of his story has always haunted me. To imagine a 30-year-old convicted murderer looking back on his life and concluding that the pivot point in his journey where everything changed was about a choice he made in ninth grade. And the choice was about his friend. So he would want to say to us, the crowd matters. But God already said that. I hope Proverbs 1 is still ringing in your ears because that is the warning the wise man was trying to give. Are you still in Proverbs 1? Look back at verse number 8. He talks about a young man who would have the wise counsel of a mother and father, and he says, that's what you need to hear. But then he warns in verse 10, if sinners entice you, there is another voice out there that we hear, brothers and sisters, the voice of the crowd in pursuit of sin. At that time, it might be that a young person would be tempted to be caught up with a band of criminals to make some quick money. But it doesn't have to be just that. It could be anything that the crowd does to pull us away from Jesus. He says, if sinners entice you, do not consent. And then again in verse 15, do not walk in the way with them. Keep your feet from their path. And so throughout this early chapter in Proverbs, in verse 1, in chapter 1 rather, what he's saying to them is, don't get caught up with that crowd. And he tells us why in verse 18. They ambush their own lives. Isn't that ironic? The plan was to go out and ambush other people and take advantage of them. But what the wise man says is they don't realize they're destroying themselves. Man, every time I read verse 18, I think about Ricky. That is exactly what he did. He ambushed his own life. Every time we let the crowd pull us into things that God does not want us to be involved in, we are making the same mistake. We're choosing the crowd over Christ. And Ricky would say, when you do that, you're headed for trouble. I believe that, folks. I think I've shared with you guys before that over the last several years, I've spent a lot of time researching prodigals. And I've interviewed seven. And I always ask them about the crowd. How much did people in the world, friends in the world, impact your decision? And without exception, every one of them describes that impact as tremendous. The crowd helped pull them away. I know that's not new this morning. That's not fresh material. This is old, well-worn ground. How many parents have warned their kids about their friends? How many times has someone stood in this pulpit and warned about the danger of, well, we'll use Jeff's word, culture, getting pulled up in the culture? What is that? That's the crowd out there. How many times have we heard the warnings? Maybe you've had a shepherd pull you aside and warn you about who you're with and urge you to be with the right crowd over and over and over. I just guess Ricky hoped that coming from someone in his position with this journey, maybe it would help us remember that the crowd matters. Brothers and sisters, we need to think about the people we surround ourselves with. Second, if Ricky speak to you today, I think he would want to say, especially to our young people, I think he would want to say, your parents matter. Some of the most moving conversations I had with him were about his mom and dad. Ricky loved his parents. He hated that his situation prevented him from being with them. They visited as much as they could, but they lived way up in Oklahoma, 8 hours away. And so they would drive down and they would visit for 4 hours and they would drive back all in the same day. Do the math. It's a whole day. And they came as much as they could, but it was just never enough for him. He wanted to see them more. It frustrated him that he couldn't have any physical contact with them. You saw the picture. You're visiting through a little glass window. He would complain sometimes when I would visit on Monday after his parents had been there on the weekend. He would complain, I couldn't even hug my mother. I think his first moment came about 5 years in when his dad died suddenly of a heart attack. No chance to say goodbye. He couldn't go be with his mother. Nobody there to comfort him. And he worried about her. He worried about her at the end because she was in bad health, and he worried that his own death might contribute to her death. Listen, he loved his mom and dad. But let's be honest about something. For a good period of his life, he didn't honor them. I need you to know that his parents did not sit quietly on the sidelines while their son drove the bus off the cliff, okay? What he did over their intense objections. He wrote me in one of his letters, he said, Daddy would try to tell me, you're going to get into trouble if you keep living like you are, but I didn't think so, remember? He said, I didn't want someone telling me how to run my life. I still remember so vividly when he got to this part of the story the first time we met at each other. I could see the tears welling up in his eyes and watched him grit his teeth as he said, David, I wish I had listened to my dad. And so I know that if he could speak to the young people in this crowd, he would want to say to you, your mom and dad matter. If you've got godly parents trying to steer you in the right direction, you need to listen to them. Mom and dads have been charged with a sacred duty. Ephesians 6:4. Paul said that parents are to bring up their children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Young people need to understand that one day your mom and dad are going to stand before God in judgment. And one of the questions he's going to be asking them is, what did they do for you? Serious business, bringing up a child. In fact, I want to let all the young people in on a secret about your parents. I may get in trouble for this because parents keep this as a closely guarded secret. But I'm going to let you in on it. After you go to bed at night, sometimes we go back in our bedroom and we shut the door, but then we sit up and we talk about you, trying to figure out what we can do tomorrow to make your life more miserable. Did you realize that we do that? And if you believe that so, you're probably wrong about a lot of other stuff too. Because parents do go back in their bedroom sometimes after their kids go to bed. And we do sit up at night fretting and wringing our hands and talking about our kids. But it is not about how to make your life miserable. Listen, what mom and dad want to do is we want to get it right. And we don't. We mess up along the way. And you need to be real good with that because, frankly, you mess up being a kid too. We're all kind of growing up together, aren't we? Parents do have some advantages. We're older. and we've seen some things and experienced some things. And you know, somebody told me this is what happens as you get older and you start having more life under your wheels, right? And you just really want to share that with others. And that's what your mom and dad want to do with you. They want to try to pass on some of our blunders and mistakes so that you don't have to suffer too, like we did. And so if you've got a mom and dad like that, Ricky would say, that matters. And you need to listen. But listen, he's behind God on that. God already said that. Are you still in Proverbs 1? Remember where this opened in verse number 8 with this admonition. Proverbs 1 and verse 8. Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Indeed, they are a graceful wreath to your head and ornaments about your neck. So before ever getting to the problem of the other voice and the sinners that are out there, the wise man has been saying, listen to your mom and dad, which by the way, is exactly what Paul said before he spoke to parents in Ephesians chapter 6. In Ephesians 6 in verse 1, look at that text. Ephesians 6, 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. Listen, I think we've done a really good job of emphasizing that word in verse 1, that word obey. And children are supposed to obey their parents. I think every kid knows that what? Like from when they're 18 months old, we get that one ingrained in their head. I don't think we've done so well with verse number 2 and the key word in that verse, which is the word honor. It is a higher level of obedience. It is one thing to do what mom and dad say because they could take away the keys and the phone. Man, that got instant obedience in my house growing up. My boys out of line, all I'd say is, drop the phone and the keys on the counter. And they're like, what may we do for you, Father? Right? That's obedience. Honor is different. Honor essentially carries the quality of value. It doesn't just mean that my dad could punish me if I don't do what's right. It means that I trust my dad and my mom. And I believe not listening to me, look at verse number 3, will not be good for me. And so I tell young people, if you've never had a moment in your life where you were determined to go this way, but then you heard from mom and dad, and decided, no, I need to go that way. I need to do differently. I need to make a different choice because my mom and dad. If that isn't happening in your life, you're probably not doing verse 2. Probably don't honor them. I'm not saying that everyone who doesn't honor their parents will end up in prison. If that were so, sermons like this wouldn't be necessary. But you may end up in a crowd of friends who get you in trouble. Or married to someone who makes you miserable. Or you might lose your soul. Don't do what Ricky did. Don't ignore the pleading of godly parents. Only to wake up one day in a mess too big to fix, saying to yourself, I wish I'd listened to my mom and dad. Parents matter. Finally, I need to close with this one. Sin. Sin matters. Ricky never imagined that his life would end up like it did. This wasn't the plan. He didn't go to his guidance counselor as a freshman and say, my ambition is to be convicted of murder and end up on death row. That wasn't the plan. In fact, he never imagined that those first seemingly small steps following a crowd of teenagers in high school would end up in such a terrible place. He shared with me during our first meeting being taken to the Ellis unit for the first time and put in his cell for the first time. And he said, I could still hear in my mind the sound of the iron doors slamming shut the first time. And he said, I just buried my head in my hands and wept and asked, How did I get here? How did I get in this mess? He's not the only one to ask that question. He never dreamed it would all cost so much. In fact, let's just be honest about that. For a good period of his life, his choices didn't seem to cost anything at all. Remember, for a decade, from 20 to 30, he lived as wicked a life as one could imagine. And if you don't mind sleeping in your car when you're out of money, he wasn't any worse for the wear. Understand that. Understand that it took that one night when all of the choices, the choice about the crowd, the choice about the drug, the choice about the life, when all of that stuff sort of collided with the most tragic of consequences. That came with a terrible price tag. It's always interesting to talk to Ricky about what was hard about being in prison. I had some presuppositions. But oddly enough, he never talked about threats to his physical safety. That was my fear, be afraid the guy sleeping in the bunk above me was going to cut my throat in the middle of the night. It happens. But Ricky was a big guy. Maybe that wasn't a problem for him. He talks about not being able to hug his mother. All the time. Interestingly, he talks about not being able to partake of the Lord's Supper. Sometimes I would come on Monday and he would sit down. First thing he would say is, "Did you partake of the Lord's Supper yesterday?" And I tried to be nice about that. I'd say, "It was Sunday, Ricky. That's what we do." He never got to do that. And he missed it terribly. Helped me appreciate hugging my mother and partaking of the Lord's Supper a little more. He hated the embarrassment he brought to his family. He shared with me one time, "Do you know what it's like for my mom when our friends ask, 'Where is Ricky? We never see him anymore. What's happened to him?'" How does a mom answer that question? And he talks about the difficulty of living with a death sentence hanging over his head. Once you're there for a few years, you kind of get how the process works. He got several execution dates along the way that he wasn't concerned about at all because he wasn't far enough along in the process. But when the last one came, he knew. And so he knew it was his last month and then his last week and then I vividly remember the last day when he had to say goodbye to his mother and his last moments as he was given a lethal concoction of chemicals that would take his life. I've never seen anybody experience something so terribly difficult. Please don't misunderstand that. I am not saying that to you so you will feel sorry for Ricky. Can I be candid about that? Ricky received the penalty imposed by the laws of the state of Texas for the crime that he committed. If you want to feel sorry for somebody, can I give you a name? Feel sorry for Thomasine Crowe. That's the victim's mother. She's a good lady. She's even heard me come preach this lesson. And she's the one that's lived without that boy all these years. Remember her. What I'm trying to say to you is that Ricky didn't see any of this coming. This wasn't the plan. And that's the problem with sin. Go back to Solomon's warning in Proverbs chapter 1. Remember, as he talks about the crowd, they promise, verse 11, "Oh, listen, we're going to have one purse that we're going to fill with precious spoil, great wealth. Throw in your lot with us. All this good stuff is going to happen." And what does the wise man say? "Listen, don't you go down that road with them because that is not how it is going to work out." Remember, verse 18, they're going to ambush their own lives. That's the way this is going to work out. Spend been that way from the beginning, brothers and sisters. That's as old Adam and Eve. It is never the way the devil works out. When are we going to figure that out? In Psalm 1, we're told about that. In Psalm 1, remember, the wise man, verse 3, is like a tree firmly planted by streams of water that yields its fruit. Verse 4, though, says the wicked are not so, but they are like chaff that the wind drives away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor the sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. It has always been so. The only question to answer is, when are we going to figure that out? You know what I think our problem is? That we think we can dabble in sin. Just a little bit. Only to find ourselves suddenly, and sometimes quite unexpectedly, just swallowed up in this trap that we didn't see coming. Think about King David. He's the perfect example. He makes a mistake. He sins. He's walking on the roof of his house. He sees a woman taking a bath. And he looks too long. And he lusts. A sin, to be sure. But is there anyone in this crowd today who doesn't understand how a guy makes a mistake like that? But please understand. There were no thoughts of murder that night on the rooftop in Jerusalem. And in fact, if someone had said, let me tell you how this is going to work out. He's going to wind up sleeping with her. She's going to end up pregnant. He's going to call back her husband and lie and deceive and try to cover up. And all that's going to fail. And eventually he's going to kill the guy. If I told you that was the plot of the story, you would say, that is the dumbest movie ever. Nobody would believe that that's how it was going to turn out. And that is exactly how it turned out. People make that same mistake all the time. They think they experiment with drugs. Young people are told that drugs and alcohol are like this rite of passage into adulthood, only to find themselves enslaved with a habit they battle for the rest of their life. Or people get involved in sexual immorality. They're even told that's a rite of passage as a young person into adulthood. Everybody sleeps around before they get married, only to find their lives permanently altered by an unexpected pregnancy or a disease. What is the point? Once we start down that road, brothers and sisters, we don't have any idea where it's going and what the consequences will be, what the price tag will be. So the point is, we ought to be afraid to ever wander out onto sin's slippery and uncertain slopes. I got to tell you what, folks, it's why I don't ski. I tried skiing one time, gave up on it because I could never master one of the skills essential to skiing. Y'all said it. You've had the problem too, right? I never figured out how to stop. And if you're a skier, do not come up to me after this and say pizza, or you need to learn how to slide. Because I did all the things that 2 days of skiing instructors taught me about how to stop. And I formed my skis in exactly the stopping position and flew down the slope at breakneck speed anyway. I did discover one guaranteed way to stop every time. That's exactly right. Just fall down and you'll stop in your spot, right? It is a terrifying thing to be flying at breakneck speed down the bunny slope toward a crowd of people and not being able to stop and no idea what disaster is coming. That is exactly what we do. We wander off into sin. We're getting out on that slippery slope, brothers and sisters, and we have no idea where we're going. None. What price tag will attach at the end. We're living in a time where the cultural mantra is that sin is no big deal. Think about how many times and how many contexts we hear people say that. It's no big deal. Hear me on this. That is a lie. Sin matters. And I know that because God sent his son to save us from it. Truth is, we're all living with a death sentence, aren't we? Everybody of an accountable age who's made the choice to sin is living under the penalty of the second death, separation from God forever because of our choice to sin. Wonderful thing about being a preacher is that we get to preach good news, and that is through Jesus Christ, we have been granted a reprieve. Through his blood, God will wipe away our sins. And so here we sit with a death sentence and an offer of a reprieve. And so I wonder if there's somebody sitting in the crowd today that needs that. You need the death sentence to be lifted. You need to be redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. You need to be saved. If that offer is extended to you today, what could keep you from going out that door without it? Why would you live one more minute under a death sentence? God, through Jesus, grants a reprieve. Will you accept that today? By confessing that you believe Jesus is the Son of God, baptized for remission of your sins, would you let him give you life instead of death? We want to help you do that. If we can, make your way to the front right now while we stand.